WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. 3 minutes after four is the time. Have you seen the film The Buddy Holly Story yet? If you haven't seen it, you've probably heard about it. The director of the film, Steve Rash, is in the studio with me now. Before we meet Steve Rash, we're going to listen to some music. Buddy Holly recorded between 1957 and 59. He was killed in a plane crash in 59. His first record, released with the Crickets in 1957, was That'll Be the Day, which Holly wrote. The song spotlighted the qualities he quickly became known for, a rough, hiccuping style of singing, heavily amplified guitar, and a rough, unpolished beat. This is how it sounded, Buddy Holly's first record, That'll Be the Day.
Love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday will I'll be true. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day. Your heart. So if we ever part, then I leave you. You sit and hold me and you tell me boldly that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day.
That'll Be the Day, Buddy Holly's first record. Holly's music influenced many American and British rock groups. People are still recording his songs. Linda Ronstadt featured That'll Be the Day on a recent album, which ended up getting a lot of radio play. The British rock group of called the Hollies paid tribute to Holly with the use of his name, and it's said that the Beatles called themselves the Beatles as a kind of wordplay on the Crickets. Well, the Beatles did record Holly's song Words of Love. Words of Love shows another side of Holly, the softer ballad side. This was recorded before the softer side of his recording career was embellished in the production process with strings and MOR arrangements. We'll hear Buddy Holly's recording of his own Words of Love and follow it with the Beatles' recording of the same.
Hold me close and tell me how you feel. Tell me love is real. Words of love you whisper soft and true. Darling, I love you. Thank you. Let me hear you say the words I want to hear. Darling, when you're near. Words of love you whisper soft and true. Darling, I love you. Soft and true. Darling, I love you.
You can hear that the Beatles probably spent a lot of time listening to Holly. We're going to hear a track next from the soundtrack album of the film The Buddy Holly Story, and you'll hear that the people who made the film also spent a lot of time listening to Holly. Gary Busey, who plays Buddy Holly in the film, sings lead. Don Stroud, who plays the percussionist Cricket, is on percussion. Charles Martin Smith, who plays the bass-playing Cricket, is on bass. It's an unusual touch that the actors actually play their own stuff for the film. We'll hear some of the music featured in the opening segment of the film. Buddy Holly and the Crickets are playing at a roller rink. The music is being broadcast live on the local station there in Texas. They're supposed to be playing country hits. After singing something by Les Paul and Mary Ford, Holly insists that they do one of their own rock and roll tunes. With these next tunes, Rock Around with Ollie V, and That'll Be the Day, they electrify the roller rink audience but lose sponsors for the radio show. This is how they do it in the film.
Thank you, love it. that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day, hey, hey, when I die. When you can shine the star, you shine it at your heart. So if we ever part, then I feel blue. Is that you tell me, baby? Is that you love me, baby? That someday when I'll be true, that'll be the day you say goodbye. That'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. That'll be the day, hey, when I die. Hey, hey, when I die, well, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day.
That was Gary Busey as Buddy Holly from the soundtrack recording of the film The Buddy Holly Story. The director of the film, Steve Rash, is with me in the studio now. This was his first feature-length film, but it was not his first encounter with placing rock and roll into a visual medium. He co-produced a 96-part rock and roll, well, rock music series for CBS. It was called Music Connection. At his first television job in Atlanta, he produced a local rock program. Steve himself was a music student before switching to film. The Buddy Holly Story breaks a lot of rules. There are no already very famous stars to attract box office. The budget is a very low $2 million. The film was produced independently. The actors who played the role of musicians also played their own instruments and sang. And it looks like the film is going to be a commercial and a critical success. Steve Rash, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Really glad you
could make it.
It's nice to be here.
I think maybe that I didn't mention that one of the rules that you've kind of broken is that you live neither in Los Angeles nor in New York, the entertainment capitals, but you live in the Philadelphia area in Wynmore. Well, let me start by asking you why of all your choices of films to be your first film to direct, since you were working on this independently, you narrowed it down to a Buddy Holly biography.
Well, I always wanted to do a rock and roll film. Or a rock film, something in that vein. And I thought that to kill two birds with one stone, I wanted to give the people in this country a greater understanding of where their musical roots came from. And I felt that other than Elvis, the only other major force in white rock and roll was Buddy Holly. And I felt that Buddy had been lost in this country's consciousness for a variety of reasons. And only the British really respected Buddy for being what he was, basically the father of white rock and roll.
Now, when you're looking at somebody, a person who really lived to be the subject of a film, I would guess that you have to see also how dramatic and possibly filmic their lives were, as well as how influential they were in the history of rock and roll.
Right. Buddy's story is in many respects the same story as the Glenn Miller story, a person who had a sound in his head, who wanted to do things differently, and who fought for what he heard and eventually triumphed and made a great contribution to our culture here. And then fate snuffed their lives out in pretty much the same way. So it had those components of what has traditionally been known as good drama. And many of the other rock and rollers who deserved to have their stories told, you know, had less attractive ends to their lives. Morrison and Joplin and those people.
Like Junk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. There are some difficulties in a biographical film that you don't have when you're creating everything from your own fantasy.
Absolutely.
For instance, you have to get people's permission to dramatize their own lives. Who did you have to go to and get formal permission from before you could even consider making the Buddy Holly story?
From his estate, which meant his widow and also his parents.
How cooperative were they?
Well, Maria, his widow, had been approached a number of times, 6 or 8 times at various points, to do Buddy's story, mostly by major studios or a couple of television networks, tried to get things going. And she always got bad vibes. She always felt that they were more interested in exploiting Buddy Holly's name value than they were in telling a story. So when push came to shove, she always declined. And Freddie Bauer, who is another Philadelphian, and I, when we got this idea to do this movie, the first thing we did was get in the car and drive down to Miami, where we found out that his widow lived. And we went to talk to her, and we told her what we wanted to do and how we wanted to do it. And basically, she had a gut reaction that we would be the most likely to do a sincere job of telling the story, and that it was more important to us than just another film. It was our very lives and our futures were wrapped up in this, and we'd better succeed, or the consequences would be much worse for us than they would be for some studio who had 100 other films on the books.
Because basically your whole career was at stake here.
Everything.
Did they ever try to convince you before you even really embarked on the details of the film, before the script was really written, that they should come off looking a certain way?
No.
You know, either the parents or Maria Elena?
No. We explained in this concept of how we wanted to do the film, we said the most important thing is that one consciousness keeps control of the project from beginning to end. Or it will get lost in someone else's concept or conflicting concepts. And we said, you'll just have to trust us that we'll, in the balance, we will do what's fair to Buddy.
What do you have to do to get other people who really existed to get rights to the use of their name and their story within the film, characters that are, you know, maybe more peripheral to his life, but nevertheless are based on real people?
Well, the legalisms are very complex. One school of thought says that if you were in close association professionally with a dead person who was in the public eye, then in that context, you cannot prevent someone telling your association with a famous person. There's another school of legalism that says, get a piece of paper anyway.
Right.
So,
but if you're using someone's name, do you have to buy the right to use their name?
Yeah, you don't have to, but it makes it so much more complicated if you don't.
Someone who is kind of conspicuously absent from the film is Norm Petty, who was Buddy Holly's producer and who was frequently given songwriting credits on a lot of Holly's hits.
Right.
He's not in the film. Holly has no producer. He's his own producer, the way the story is told within the film. What's the story there? Did you approach Norm Petty, his producer, and ask for permission to use his name? And
yes, we did. Norman wanted script approval, basically, and since we hadn't given it to the estate and we had decided not to give it to a major studio, then we shouldn't give it to anyone. So it boils down to we couldn't make a deal.
So suddenly someone who was a part of Holly's career is absent.
Yeah, there are others too.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are in the course of anyone's professional life, even if it's a short one, there are a lot of characters who contribute. And in most cases, the characters are condensed for brevity's sake into one figure that represents more than one person. For example, there were 3 or 4 disc jockeys in Lubbock that believed in Buddy and believed in his music and gave him help along the way. But again, for the sake of brevity, we condensed those down into one character who encompasses that contribution of all of them.
Getting back to to Petty again, the way the story is told within the film. Buddy Holly is walking around with a sound in his head, and he produces his own records. He basically does his own arrangements and becomes an auteur of rock and roll, which was, to my understanding, not really heard of in those days. It's kind of with the Beatles that you have singer, songwriter, arranger, producer all rolled into one starting to occur.
There were others. Les Paul,
right,
in particular, was very much an auteur of his music.
Well, so that's, I guess, at least mildly fictionalized, that Holly is
an auteur. It is simplified. It's not much of an overstatement. From all accounts that I've been able to get, it was always Buddy's sound, and there were a lot of people that helped him get it, helped him write down the notes so that other people, the strings, for example, could play those sounds. And there were engineers and producers who helped Buddy, especially in the early days, get it on tape, go through the technical process of recording it. And in summation, especially in the last year of Buddy's life, he was pretty much doing it all. And from all accounts, his idea of where he was going was more into the production area than the performing area. He saw his life as a performer being a very short one, but moving on into producing other people. As a matter of fact, he produced Waylon Jennings' first record, and had plans at the time of his death to produce a lot of other artists, Ray Charles, and he was going to branch out into a lot of different areas. As you can see by his latter music, he was already dipping into what you could call the MOR type of arrangements, sweeter. So he was going in a lot of different directions.
There are people like me in the audience for your film who, as soon as it's over, like, run to their books about rock and roll and look up Holly in the index and try to see how much of the film is, absolutely real, based on fact, and how much of it is fictionalized. As the filmmaker here, as the director of the film, is that a response that you'd kind of like to have? Would you like to, would it make you happy if a lot of people started running to rock and roll books and going back to Buddy Holly records?
It's about time. That's one of the main reasons for making the film, is that nobody knows who Buddy Holly is. And hopefully this film will tell them.
How comfortable are you, though, like, with nitpicking? Like, I have a list here of sequences that I wasn't sure if they really occurred or not. Maybe we'll go over them later.
I'm not sensitive at all.
As far as, like, the accuracy, I mean, how you said that you, like, distilled, say, three people into one for the purposes of brevity,
yeah,
and of a dramatic device, I guess.
Right.
But that leaves a somewhat, misrepresented sense, though I guess you could say that
the only way to do a totally accurate story would be for it to be 2.5 years long.
Uh-huh.
Then you would be 100% accurate. Anything less than real time is an inaccuracy by and of itself. So anytime you're limited to 2 hours or less, then it's grossly inaccurate, especially from a temporal standpoint. But that's what movies are, is, condensing time and space. You don't want to do a movie that moves as slow as life really moves, or nobody would be interested.
Did you go back to other biographical films that were done and get a sense of how directors had handled?
No, not really. I thought that this wouldn't benefit from the old construction. As it turned out, the structure is very close to, for example, the Glenn Miller story. In other words, it's in continuity. It doesn't jump around with flashbacks and so forth. It's a very straightforward construction, and I think that's because both situations demanded the same kind of structure.
The feeling for the 1950s that's in your film struck me when I was seeing it as being very, very well done, with a really terrific eye for details, and not overstated and made ridiculous like some other movies and TV shows about the 50s that are available for viewing now. can you talk a little bit about, like, what perspective you used to, portray the 1950s? Where were you?
Well, one thing we wanted for sure is that we did not want a 50s movie where the 50s is a driving part of the film. Rather, we wanted to make a movie that just happened to be in the 50s. And we wanted to take the audience back to the 50s and try to keep from snapping them back to the present. And every time you're tempted to point up some juicy little remembrance from the past, if you yield to that temptation and look at it with a little bit of cynicism from today, then bang, the audience is back for that moment in today's perspective. When we tried to look at everything that was in the 50s from the 50s point of view rather than from the 70s point of view.
I think that's really very important, and I think it really worked in the film.
It's a subtlety that's a lot stronger than you would imagine, I think, going in.
Well, I think you're right, you know, that a film gives itself away. Like, you can see films made in the 60s about the 40s, for instance. You could tell it was made in the 60s because the clothes look like 60s renditions of what people wore in the 40s, and
yeah.
It's really a giveaway, and the film looks really dated.
Yeah. But the minute you take a close-up of a poodle skirt, then you're saying to the audience, hey, look, we're in the 50s. And all of a sudden, for that instant, they're no longer concerned with the story as it's happening.
Because, like, if you shot it in the 1950s, you wouldn't have to give a close-up on the skirt because you'd know it was the 1950s.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
lovely. So, who did you, like, find someone, for instance, to, like, be the costume designer, to dress everybody just so?
Yeah. The overall art director has done fabulous work, Rosemary's Baby in particular. Beautiful art direction, The Reavers, and several other fine films. And he was able to stick to his guns and do it with subtlety and taste and resist the temptations to really garish things up, to try to, you know, oversell the 50s. And that same concept carried down through the, you know, the props, wardrobe, hair, and everything. You know, let's play it cool and don't, you know, let's don't get all excited about the 50s.
Perhaps the most significant aspect, I wouldn't say detail because it's far more than a detail in the film, is the way that in the 1970s, three people who were not involved with the Crickets played the Crickets' music.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about how you all decided what approach you're going to use to getting both, like, the mixing, the technology of the music down, you know, the filmic ends of it, and the playing of the music itself?
Well, we felt that we were faced with a choice of two roadways, really. One would be to use the original Buddy Holly recordings.
Yeah, can you elaborate on that? Because
it all depended on casting. I felt that if you're going to tell a story about a performer and much of the film is going to be involved with the performance, you better get a performer up there who has gigged in front of people before, or he'll never sell it. He may play all the notes in perfect timing, his lip sync may be absolutely perfect in timing, but somewhere in some level of your mind, subconscious probably, you know it's not real. And although you may sit there and enjoy it and respond to it, it's only on a cerebral level because it's not real, it's fantasy. But if the guy is singing his own notes and playing his own guitar, and he's up there sweating, you can see the veins stand out on his neck, you can see his eyes, you know. You can tell. And once you buy that guy up there on stage as Buddy Holly and that he's really doing what he's supposed to be doing up there, then the rest of the movie will take care of itself.
Had you considered at all the possibility of using records?
Well,
using Buddy Holly's records.
I had always considered that to be second choice, but probable. I never dreamed that we would actually find someone who could act as well as we needed for the star and also sing. So up until we found Gary, we were always prepared to take an actor who couldn't sing and do the lip sync trip. And it would have been a different kind of film. We're really fortunate that we found Gary.
I don't know if I've ever seen a musical biography where original recordings of the artist's work were really used, you know, and lip synced over the original recording. Somehow it's always somebody else playing
Jolson?
The
wasn't,
music of.
Wasn't that Jolson's original voice? Larry Parks?
Maybe.
I think
maybe.
It was.
I've always thought that a problem might be like the scratches in the recordings.
It is. That,
you
is,
know,
a small,
that
is something
be
of
a kind
a
of giveaway.
A bigger problem, though, is the ambiance of the recording. You know, they're all studio recordings, done with 1950s technology, which means they're not terribly clean to begin with. And also, if you tried to use a record that was cut in a studio like this one, and your picture was in a hall with 1,000 people sitting there, again, your brain is going to tell you that sound is not coming in this building. They're not together. They're not real. And again, you'd have that separation of reality.
Speaking of the mix that was used, there was a, as we heard in the Roller Rink medley a little earlier, that was played from the soundtrack, the mix of the music is very rough, just as it ought to sound, I think, because, I mean, after all, it was a rough rock and roll band in the 1950s playing in a roller rink, right. But there's always that chance, you always see it in a film, that it's somehow, it's gorgeous, you know, like it was, you know, produced in, like, the finest state-of-the-art studio.
I think you'll find in the scenes where they're in a recording studio, though, it sounds...
sweeter,
mix, yeah. The mix is better, the quality is better, and it's a deader sound, or more of a studio sound. We wanted Buddy Holly on stage to sound like Buddy Holly sounded on stage.
I think somehow that's rare in a music film. Is that one of the reasons why you wanted to do the film independently?
Yes, we would never have been allowed to do it that way with a major. Everybody in Hollywood said, "You're crazy.
Why?
You don't know what you're doing. You don't know what's going to happen to you. You can't do this. Multi-track unsprocketed tape running at 150 feet a minute and try to sync it up with sprocketed film that's running at 90 feet a minute. People said, you know, it's too big of a headache, you can't do it. Well, that was the easiest thing for us because that's what we've been doing for almost 10 years for television. You know, the technical complexity of that didn't faze us because we designed over the years our own system for doing that. So we had to just say to all the crew and everybody, just relax, it's going to work out fine. And it did.
Did all the people who played Buddy Holly and the Crickets, so were they all formerly musicians? Was Don Stroud a percussionist?
No. Here's a funny story. Don Stroud came in to read for another part, actually. He came in to read for one of the disc jockeys. And something about his demeanor and attitude really felt like what this character should be. And we asked him if he played the drums. He said, "Oh, sure, I had a rock and roll band when I was in high school, and I play the drums, you know, actors will tell you anything." It turns out that coming from Hawaii, he was a surfer, very much into the surfing idiom, and played bongos on the beach. So he, you know, he knew rhythms, and he had a pretty good set of hands on him from playing the bongos, but he'd never sat down at a set of drums. And in 8 weeks, he's practiced 8 to 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, in an empty soundstage, and actually learned to play the drums.
Some people, I'm sure, would make the argument that was time that could have been spent doing something else. You would have been better off finding someone who already played or dubbing it in or something.
Yeah. Got a lot of arguments like that.
Yeah. Well, he did a fine job in the role.
Yeah. And he's believable when he's sitting at those drums. You know he's playing. There's no possibility that he's not playing. And it's a big difference.
As the director of the film, what kind of, what's like some of the advice that you gave Gary Busey, for instance, about how he should portray Holly, the facial expressions, the kind of duck walking that he would be doing on stage?
Well, a lot of Gary's movements on stage are his own. We had long discussions about the way Buddy would have behaved on stage and going by some secondhand accounts of how he did appear. And we talked in general about the character and, you know, the way his attitude would be on stage. Gary and I come from the same part of the country, which is very close to where Buddy came from. So our views of his personality were very close. Gary and I knew this kid because, you know, he came from where we came from. So there were no fundamental conflicts between Gary and I as to how the character should be played. I guess probably the most important piece of advice I gave Gary was to throw everything away. Don't think about the significance of anything. None of this is important. Because to Buddy at the time, it wasn't. He was having a ball. And there was no profundity or deep social meaning or anything to what was going on with them. And I said, try to keep that in mind. Forget it. It's not important. None of this is important. You're just having a good time.
Now, to people listening now who haven't seen the film, that might sound really, like, unusual and, like, you know, what kind of director is this trying to make the film superficial? But when I was seeing the film, I really noticed that he wasn't trying to make everything, like, overly profound, which is another thing that I so frequently see in movies.
And it turns out stronger than it would be if he played it big. There's something about not taking yourself seriously that's really, it really speaks of reality.
Were there takes that were shown to all the performers, you know, the musician performers, to give them a sense of how they were looking so that they could, like, see it and use that as feedback?
No, we didn't have time.
Uh-huh.
It would have been nice to shoot it with a combined video film system where you could, look back at things and make adjustments and so forth.
So they never had a chance to see that?
They never saw themselves until they saw the film. They never played in front of an audience until that roller rink. It was more of an experience, I think, for the actors than it was for the kids. Now, these 16 and 17-year-old kids in the roller rink, they'd never heard Root Rock and Roll either, except on a tinny radio. So for them, it was quite a shock to see three guys come out there and hit them with that real simple, raw rock and roll. But for the actors, to see those kids' eyes, you know, get so big and them get so excited, and then the kids called for an encore that was not planned. I didn't tell them to do that. And that just gave the band, I talk of the three guys as a band because they were a band, it just gave them this incredible confidence. Hey, we are a rock and roll band. And the excitement level, you'd have to be an idiot to miss that. And you can't miss it in filming when it's that kind of real intense excitement. You know, you don't have to create it. It's there.
How do you as the director deal with, I don't know whether they were actors or extras, the teenagers and adults who were in the roller rink in that opening scene?
Both actors and extras.
How do you direct them? Because they're in a big group. I mean, you're not working with them as closely as with Gary Busey.
Well, some of the shots are, carefully staged and set up shots for specific things that I knew I needed. But a lot of the really exciting shots come from the situation rather than from telling them to jump up and clap.
But they knew how clapping was done in the 1950s, where you clap and then you kind of roll and wave your hand to the right, and you mm-hmm. clap again, you roll your left hand to the left.
Yeah.
People don't really clap that way anymore, but they did in the
1950s. Yeah, well, those things, you know, were choreographed and, you know, and told. But their excitement, you know, the energy level was their own.
If you're just tuning in now, I'm speaking with Steve Rash, who is the director of the film The Buddy Holly Story that opened in Philadelphia last Wednesday. Did you do a lot of takes of the music performances, either for visual or for sound qualities of the performance?
No, we used multiple cameras to minimize the number of takes because it was live. Anytime you do another take, there's a chance that the tempo is going to move a little bit faster or slower. So we tried to do as few as possible. Now, there were four or five complete takes on some of the sequences, but each one of those takes had three or in some cases four cameras running. So it's the equivalent of, 12 or 15 takes.
Mm-hmm. A soundtrack record has, which we heard a little from before, we'll hear a little more later, a soundtrack record from the film has been released. Was that automatic, or was that something that you decided to do? I mean, did you know automatically that, of course, you have to have a soundtrack record for a music film?
I think it's automatic. You need desperately, in this age of marketing, you need a hit single to sell a movie of almost any kind. You either need a monster superstar or a hit record. And Robert Stigwood has been very successful in promotion through the radio stations playing the soundtrack album or the single, whatever.
Do you think that, given that Buddy Holly's records are still available, they've been reissued on record labels, MCA, I think it is, given that that's still available, do you think there's any chance of making a hit out of Gary Busey's very good renditions of Buddy Holly's work, but it's not Buddy Holly, and Buddy Holly records are around?
It's selling. It's selling right up there with the original re-release. There's well over 200,000 copies already sold,
uh-huh.
which is not bad.
Are you surprised? Or
no, I think, I would have been surprised had I not seen how effective the film was. I think a lot of that is due to someone wanting to recapture, an effective moment for them in the film.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other rock and roll films. You mentioned Robert Stigwood, who's producer of Grease and Saturday Night Fever and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And then there's also American Hot Wax, which I saw, I think, the night after, the first time I saw the Buddy Holly story. And there's a scene in there where the president of the Buddy Holly fan club goes on Alan Freed's program, which I thought was a marvelous interplay.
Yeah.
Did you have any idea that when you started this film 4 years ago that it was going to be released right in the middle of a whole gamut of rock and roll?
No,
films?
Because I didn't think it would take as long as it did. I thought it was a 2-year process when in the beginning. It took so much longer to raise the money than we thought it would that actually most of these other rock films were started considerably after ours. And I think a few of them started because of ours. You know, all through the process of trying to raise the money, we were doing as much promotion as we could about the Buddy Holly story. And I think that has a great deal to do with the success in selling the Alan Freed story. They started that considerably later.
Is there anything you had to do to protect the major companies who you didn't want to deal with, you know, because you wanted to produce it independently, from themselves doing their own Buddy Holly story and coming out 2 years before yours, because they have...
The only protection is in getting independent financing.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you take money from a major, you give up some portion of control. The amount of control you give up depends on how much money you take from them. So that was our big battle all the way through, was not to have to go to the majors and say, I want to make a deal with you, to finish the film and then go to the distributors and say, we have this film we'd like for you to consider distributing, and that's what we did.
When we started talking, we were talking a bit about Maria Elena Holly, Buddy Holly's wife, and his parents, who all had to give permission to film the Buddy Holly story. What were their reactions when they saw the film?
They were universally touched, and that was the most gratifying thing to me. Even more so than the public's acceptance is Maria's and Mr. and Mrs. Holly's. Mr. Holly stood up at the premiere in Lubbock, and he said, "That's my boy." And some of the crickets who have seen the film were deeply touched by how close Gary got to the character. In fact, Nikki Sullivan, one of the crickets, said to Gary, "You got inside the man."
Mm-hmm.
Very touching.
The parents were portrayed in the film as being two nice people who go about their business, but surely have like no understanding of rock and roll, and were less than supportive of Buddy Holly's
efforts. That's probably that's probably a misconception. They were more supportive of Buddy than the few scenes they're in would seem to indicate. They, of course, didn't exactly understand what Buddy was trying to do, but they certainly didn't stand in his way. And although the film doesn't say that they did stand in his way, there are no scenes in there where they're giving him their support.
Sometimes I think a biographical film falls apart during the love interest sequences, because even a film with restraint sometimes gets very dramatic when it comes to showing the hero or heroine passionately involved with someone. What kind of considerations did you give to the direction of the love sequences?
Well, I tried to keep in mind always that these were kids. He was 22 years old. And again, if you have a 22-year-old in a deeply dramatic scene, it can stretch your believability only because they're kids. You know, they're still exploring themselves and their mates, and they're not... I didn't want to try to construct some deeply dramatic relationship between them, because they didn't have much time. They were only married 5 months.
It's not very long at all.
No, it's not.
This is just a detail, but there's one scene where they're lying in bed together. They embrace for a moment of the scene and then, you know, talk lovingly for the rest. It's a fairly short scene. But they're both under the covers. And I said, well, I mean, very consciously, this is not going to be like an erotic love scene. This is just, you know, revealing part of their personality that you can.
Yeah. Again, it goes back to that whole thing of the 50s approach. I wanted to take a 50s approach to a love scene rather than a 70s approach to a love scene.
Interesting. How much of the film was shot on location and how much was shot in studios or, you know, on created sets?
About 60-40, about 60% on location and 40% on sound stages.
How did you get access to sound stages since you were not working with a major company?
Well, there are a number of independent sound studios in Los Angeles. We were lucky enough to get into the Culver City Studios, the old Cecil B. DeMille Studios, where they shot Gone with the Wind and a lot of other really neat films. And they were much, much cheaper than the major studios, and no studio overhead charges or any of that stuff. So we sort of had the run of the place.
There's a sequence at the Apollo Theater. Was that shot at the Apollo?
No, that was shot in California in a theater there. And the exterior was shot in Atlanta.
Must be a great surprise to people driving down the street and seeing like their Atlanta Lowe's or whatever suddenly transformed into the Apollo.
Yeah, it's a kick, I think.
That scene was one of the sequences that I wasn't really sure of if it really happened when I was watching it, and I wanted to find out.
Yeah, it's a true story.
The story is that in the film that Buddy Holly is the first white act to play the Apollo on a black tour.
Well, it had a record released, That'll Be the Day It Was. And in New York, because the name on the label was the Crickets, everybody in New York assumed that this was another one of the black groups like the Spiders and the Spaniels and the Orioles. And this was a very black-sounding music at the time. Because Elvis's music was still basically country rock. And Buddy's music was, if anything, closer to the black side of rock and roll. And so everybody just assumed that it was a black group, and they showed up at the Apollo and surprised everybody considerably.
So that's true.
That's true,
that's
story.
Part of it. The name the Crickets is said to have influenced the Beatles in the choice of their name. You were telling me that you recently met Paul McCartney.
Yeah,
did you ask him about that?
I had to ask him if that was true, because, you know, there are a lot of legends that arise because they make sense, not because they're true. And I asked him if that were true. And he said, yeah, it's absolutely true, but probably not for the reason you think. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, in America, the Crickets was an engaging name because it was a singing insect. But in England, they have no crickets, but they have a game called cricket. So all the kids, sports fans that they were in London and the rest of England, really, really identified with a group called the Crickets. And John and Paul understood the subtleties of the fact that it was another play on the words because they knew about the American cricket. And when they chose their name, they also wanted to be in the same vein, so they chose the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The film, as I've mentioned, was an independent film. And I'm sure that a lot of people in the industry now have their eyes on you since the film has been successful, both, I think, in terms of box office and the critics' reviews of it. What does that mean? I mean, you get the feeling that that's true, that people
oh, yeah.
are kind of watching.
Well, Hollywood is one gigantic bandwagon. And as soon as you score, then everybody in town wants to jump on that bandwagon. So we've been getting a lot of attention from people wanting to do this and that.
What are some of the things that you think you might have proved in that film that, you know, you can do if you want to do it? We were talking before, for instance, about recording music, you know, live on the film and having the actors really be the musicians as well instead of dubbing it in. Is there anything similar to that that you think would have been scorned on, you know, and said that if you had worked with a major studio, they would have said, no, sorry, you can't do it that way?
Well, a major studio would never have let us cast Gary Busey. We would have had to cast David Cassidy or some name in the role. And we felt that it can't be a recognizable name or recognizable face, or you end up with a real problem in transcending that name value when he's supposed to be Buddy Holly. So there's another example of the studios would have made us do it the traditional way, which is to get a star.
Mm-hmm. Busey, that is also in his early 30s, I think, whereas Holly mm-hmm. was 19 to 21 during the period that the film supposed to take place mm-hmm. in. It doesn't look that way, not to me.
No.
What did you have to do to... I'm sure he looks older than that.
Yeah, he's an actor.
Yeah.
He knows how to look young. It has to do with his body English and his demeanor and the way of he spaces his words and so forth. Little subtleties that you really can't put your finger on, but that say to your eye and to your brain, this is a young guy.
The film, of course, takes place, the beginning of the film in Lubbock, where Holly and the Crickets are all from. Have you been down there? Have they been showing the film down there?
Yeah, in fact, the film opened in Texas in May. That was the first part of the release pattern. And was very successful in Lubbock. And he's finally, I think, getting his due in his hometown. You know, sometimes you're less of a star in your hometown than you are anywhere else in the world. And for years, that was the case with Buddy Holly. For example, he came back to London in the late 50s. Came back to Lubbock from London in the late 50s after a triumphant European and Japanese tour. And got off the plane. Nobody met him. That they could have cared less at the time.
You yourself live in the suburbs of Philadelphia,
yeah.
And common knowledge says that anyone who's going to like make it in the film industry really ought to move right now to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Are you also that's going to work, I guess.
Well, I think it's a matter of going against the grain. When I had to decide a number of years ago where I wanted to work from, you have to have access to New York and Los Angeles because, like you said, that's the entertainment centers. But I didn't want to join the ranks of other fledgling directors in Hollywood, thousands of them, who are trying to get a gig. Because what happened, the way I felt about it at the time, is what would happen to me is that in the process of working my way up through the ladder, I would give away a lot of the tricks that I have in my bag, and by the time I finally got the shot in 10 or 15 years, I might have already used up, you know, what my limited repertoire is. I think everybody, almost any musician or artist has a limited number of changes in their head, and I didn't want to waste them on other people's work, so I felt that it would be best to stay out of town and make the mistakes out of town, and then come in to Los Angeles already an educated filmmaker rather than a fledgling.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like a move is maybe imminent. But
no, I'll never live. I'm renting an apartment in Malibu because I have to be there 3 out of the next 6 months. But I don't think I'll ever settle in Los Angeles.
What brought you to become a resident of the Philadelphia area? I know that you are from Texas.
Well, I wanted to be within commuting distance of New York or Los Angeles, and there's no such thing in Los Angeles. You know, commuting distance still puts you right in Los Angeles. It's so big. And I didn't want to live in New York because I don't like big cities as a rule. And Philadelphia, you know, has so much cultural advantages, and it has Fairmount Park, and it has a lot of other things that make it bearable as a city for me, a country boy. So I just decided to take up residence here.
Well, I have one last question for you.
Okay.
Do you play rock and roll, or, you know, did you used to? I mean, because you seem
no,
to
I was
such
into,
a strong...
I was into classical music.
Uh-huh.
I was a music major in college, and in 1965, I heard Michelle by the Beatles, and it was not the kind of music I had been trained to play, and I said, forget it, you better do something else. So that's when I got involved with the Beatles, really, is when I got involved in rock and roll and stopped playing, by the way.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Steve Rash, I want to thank you very much for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air. Steve Rash is the director of The Buddy Holly Story, which is playing in Philadelphia now. It's the film of the life of Buddy Holly.